This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The 2020 death that recalls the 1955 murder of Emmett Till. The family of 15-year-old Kawan Bobby Charles is sounding the alarm over his disappearance and his death. Local law enforcement officials say the cause of death is drowning. His family says the corpse tells a very different story. Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal join me now to talk about this tragedy and more for our recurring series Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. We'll also dig into a new ad campaign from Beats by Dre and preview a documentary about the first black high school rowing team who came from the west side of Chicago. Natalie Bullock Brown is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Natalie, welcome back. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University, and author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
What's up, Frank?
Natalie, let's talk a little bit about the story, Baldwin, Louisiana. How did you hear about Bobby's story?
I'm trying to remember how I heard about it. I think it was on social media. In fact, that's where I saw it. I believe I saw it on the page of activist Sean King, who I follow on Instagram. And then I saw another post by another activist. And I was like, why haven't I heard about this young man? So I looked into the story myself and was just horrified, by initially just the scant details. There wasn't much information, and no one really knew what had happened to Kawan, most of all his family. Police were not, didn't seem to be forthcoming with whatever they knew. But I do remember that, there was this immediate comparison to Emmett Till, because apparently Kawan's mom, took a photo of her son's face and circulated it in similar fashion to Mamie Till. Because she wanted people to be aware of what had happened to her son, that it did not look like he had drowned, and she wanted people to pay attention.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Mark, as Natalie says, not a lot of attention outside of social media at first. What do we know about Kawan's death?
As has been related, he went outside, he was picked up by a couple of folks. And that's kind of like the end of the story,
yeah.
Until, the body's found, a day later. It speaks to a bunch of things, right? We've long been in a media infrastructure in which missing black people, missing black children, generally don't rate the same kind of media attention that we see for, the nominal white woman or white girl who will disappear every month and have a huge campaign, in support of finding her, and rightfully so. But we don't see that same kind of attention shown to young black folks. And then the general kind of lack of care and concern from law enforcement, as if somehow, black kids disappearing is something that's normative and doesn't rate, further investigation, which is also very problematic, obviously, in a case like this.
Yeah. I mean, we've told what details we have are that Bobby gets in a car with a friend and the friend's mother and then is found dead. The police say it's drowning. We don't hear anymore about the friend, the friend's mother, and investigation into who they are, where they might have gone, and how the drowning might have taken place. It just sort of ends there. And Bobby was reported missing by his mom, Roxanne Nelson, who says that the police should have done more at that point. Here she is talking to ABC.
They could have done more. They didn't. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. Had they done what they were supposed to do, my son would be alive today. But I feel because my son was black, it didn't matter to them.
A clip from Good Morning America, an interview with Roxanne Nelson, the mother of Kawan Bobby Charles. Bobby's family is questioning. So first of all, you know, why not follow up on the missing person report? Why not follow up on how he went missing? And how is it that you say he's drowned, given the and there's an autopsy that's apparently been scheduled or planned, but we don't have the results. Natalie, talk more about this question of the different kind of treatment that he receives, and Roxanne Nelson's observation that race was an issue in this case.
Well, I think, you know, I read an article that was published by The Root, which is a black online publication. And, you know, one of the things that Kawan's mom describes is the, like, hours after she and her and Kawan's father realized that he was not responding, that he was not in his room at his dad's house where he was staying, that Roxanne goes to her ex-husband's house. And on her way, she flags down a police officer. And when she tells him that her son is missing, he asks, well, you know, or he doesn't ask. He says, well, he's probably at a football game. He's probably at his friend's house. He's probably, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then, you know, said, does he have a troubled past? Like, what does... Why would you ask that of a mother? Mm-hmm. And you don't know her or her child, right? And so I think that Kawan's mom has reason to think that there was some sort of disregard for her son because of his race, because she's asked questions that no white mother or father would be asked about their child. And so I think that, you know, there's a way that that law enforcement is callous, certainly, towards Black families when a loved one is killed or is missing and then is discovered to have been killed. But I also think that there's a way that they think we're stupid, because I refuse to look at the picture of Kawan, but based on the description that his mother gives of his, it doesn't even look like he has a mouth anymore. And the water that he was found supposedly drowned in was only maybe ankle deep. There is something not right with that picture. And the family has a right to ask questions. It makes complete sense that they would question the validity of what the police are telling them. So I think that there's a lot about this case that just points to this larger problem of disregard, disrespect, lack of concern for what happens in the Black community.
Talk more about that, the release of that picture, Mark, that relates back to a 1955 killing, Emmett Till, and the way in which perhaps white memory and Black memory holds that 1955 event and the way it's come forward, and now the impact of releasing that photo today.
You know, it's amazing because, you know, Mamie Till, God bless her, you know, was very savvy, media savvy, and understood that if she wanted to bring attention, you know, to her son's murder, she had to take advantage of the visuals that she knew would obviously shock Black Americans, but also shock, you know, quite a few white Americans. When you hear stories about the lines, you know, around the street, you know, for people to get a chance to glimpse at Emmett Till's body, you know, as an interesting comparison, you saw those same lines at the National Museum of African American Culture, History and Culture, you know, when they staged, you know, his, you know,
the wake, yeah.
State, same kind of lines within the museum. And then just most recently with Lovecraft Country, you know, making a reference to that, you know, this is something that's part of, you know, you would describe Black people's institutional memory, right? A foundational memory about, you know, anti-Black violence, particularly against Black children. And so it obviously is going to resonate, you know, for you know, black folks. I mean, we often find ourselves in conversations about these visualizations of black trauma and anti-black violence, you know, whether it's the case of Emmett Till or the, you know, classic photo, iconic photo of the former slave with the lashes on his back. And we often find ourselves having to intervene in the emotional breakdown of our white peers in looking at these photos than actually ever dealing with the reality of what this anti-black violence means in our lives.
Well, let's talk about the way in which that those photos in 1955 and again today and all through and every year since should have had the kind of impact that they have not. They haven't had globally here in the United States the sort of impact that you would hope that they would, because we have to keep telling the story over and over. The institutional barrier to the emotional release that this should cause, or the and the some resolution that it should cause. Mark, you referred to it. It's the media. It's this mediated experience in which black lives are pointed as contextualized one way and white lives reflected another. Go back to that moment and talk about the way media reflects these missing people and reinforces certain ideas about who is important and who's not.
Now, I mean, when you think about the Johnson Publishing Company, you know, publishers of Ebony and Jet Magazine, it really was these photos that circulated in Johnson Publishing that allowed for America to pay attention to this case. You know, it goes back to Natalie's earlier point, you know, when the mainstream corporate media was not covering this story, you had to go to places like TheRoot.com, you know, a black publication that focused on those kinds of things. So it's an important contribution to these narratives when these narratives are not seen as necessary and important, you know, within other corporate structures.
Mark Anthony Neal is James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Back Channel continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Back Channel today, our recurring series Connecting Culture and Contact with Mark Anthony Neal from Duke University and Natalie Bullock Brown from NC State. And I want to turn now to an ad campaign for Beats by Dre, gorgeous 2-minute long film directed by Melinda Matsoukas and written by Lena Waithe with music by Solange Knowles. Natalie, describe the visuals in this ad for us.
I mean, they are gorgeous. They're stunning. They put me in the mind of some of the images from Beyoncé's Lemonade, and that's chiefly because the director of this commercial, Alina Matsoukas, is also one of the creatives behind Lemonade. But you know, it's just rich and vibrant in terms of the color, the color saturation even. You know, it just shows blackness in its most beautiful light. And I think that is rare. You know, we were talking about media before. It's rare to see black people depicted and represented in such richness. And really with an eye towards making us look our best.
Well, let's get a little
gorgeous video.
Let's get a little sense of what it sounds like.
You love how I look, my hair, this skin, but me, nah. We don't get to exist. We're forced to survive. We still fight. We still play while the world burns on fields that ain't even level. All men are created equal. That's my favorite part. You hate us so deeply, but you're still so impressed. Why can't you see? There's history in our skin. You built this country on our backs. I'm him. He's me. She. Us, we are all black, black.
Power! Power to live right, I got the
power!
Power! Power to walk right, we got
power!
That's a clip from the new ad by Beats by Dre, directed by Melina Matsoukas, written by Lena Waithe, music by Solange Knowles, talking about it on Back Channel with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, what did you make of this ad?
It was arresting, for lack of a better word to describe it, visually arresting. The use of the black and white, particularly in that context, the music was arresting. And it follows a formula that, you know, hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but that Beats by Dre has been doing for a few years now, you know, going back to their ads 4 or 5 years ago with Colin Kaepernick, you know, even before he became the Colin Kaepernick that we know him. The infamous Richard Sherman commercial, you know, with I'm a Man, that was broadcast, you know, right after the 2016 Super Bowl. And at least in this particular moment, right, it's another example, and in this case, a black example of, you know, virtue signaling. The kind of things that Procter & Gamble did with their commercials, the look and the talk, you know, it fits within that same kind of tradition. And I think, you know, for someone like Dr. Dre, you know, it's an opportunity for him to be able to weigh in, to have some sort of race man consciousness, if you will, you know, in the context of using his brand, you know, to weigh in on these social issues that are happening in the country at this point in time.
Well, talk more about the message that you know, here's something that consumers, American consumers, have found no problem consuming, but when it comes to kind of social equality and the social justice that should go along with it, not there. And to tackle that head on, that's directly the message in this ad, right?
Yeah. And it's an ongoing story, right? You know, one of the most memorable scenes in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing is based on this conversation, right? The white pizza owner's son, you know, who loves Prince and loves Michael Jackson and Michael Jordan, but really can't stand black folks, right? And so it's doubling down on this in a moment in time when, you know, America at least thinks that it's had some sort of breakthrough, you know, some sort of epiphany around race, and reminding them, yeah, you know, just buying our products is just one part of that epiphany.
But you know where I'm going to go. Natalie, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, it's also this ad is coming out at a time when, you know, 73 million people voted for Donald Trump. And presumably, a lot of these people, at least at some point, may have been affected by, changed by, on some level, the protests, but grew weary of hearing about Black Lives Matter and all these other things that are related to an emphasis on Blackness. And, you know, and decided that, okay, well, I did that. That was trendy for a minute, but I think that the ad, as Mark says, it doubles down on this idea. Like, we're not going anywhere. We're still going to be talking about Black Lives Matter. We're still going to be talking about police brutality and defunding the police and all these things that you don't want to hear about. And isn't it interesting that you love our culture, but you really don't love us, do you?
Well, I want to go off on a little bit of a tangent here, and we're going to the connecting point is this notion that there's something we love, and then for a subset of Americans, something we can't abide, right? We look at what happens in 2018. Black Lives Matter is in the ascendancy, and it has an enormous impact at the polls when we see a real change taking place. But when Donald Trump is at the head of the ticket as one individual with a very particular message, then it seems to that message that carried the day in 2018 seems to be derailed. So what do you think is going on there? And it's at the, Mark, let me ask you, it's at the center of this message, this paradox, that when it's embodied by an individual, everybody gets their identity and, you know, marches to the polls and does their thing. But with that, without that individual, there's a far different sense. I mean, this is one interpretation of the difference between 2018 and 2020. There's a far different interpretation of what these movements mean and what our relationship is. Mark?
Yeah, you know, and a big part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, however you might feel about Donald Trump, he's been tremendously savvy and even brilliant at times in the ways that he's utilized and exploited media culture. And in some ways, right, his platform is much more palpable and much wider, you know, than Dr. Dre or Black Lives Matter, right? So it's not surprising, right, that he could, you know, carry a heavy hammer in this regard, you know, bully pulpit, if you will.
Nelly?
And I also want to say that, you know, in like manner, I think you know, Dr. Dre has used media. He has used Beats by Dre. He has used his ability to negotiate these spaces that in some ways cover, you know, the violence of, you know, what he has represented, but also the physical violence that he has, you know, focused, targeted certain Black women in hip hop. You know, I'm thinking about Dee Barnes. That there's still, I don't believe, there still hasn't been an apology. The film that was done about NWA, you know, really didn't address Dee. So I think there's a way that Dr. Dre also knows how to use media to, you know, to manipulate an image, his image, but also the message to sort of, I won't say co-opt, but to utilize it in a way that is to his benefit.
Well, I'll say co-opt. Mark, you know where I'm going with this next, which is this medium is the message, using the very industry that is at the center of all of our grief, the idea that somehow buying things and using commercial messaging is going to save us, has precisely brought us to this point, and yet it also seems to be the message here.
Yeah, I mean, it's that weird moment we are, right, where so much investigative journalism gets done in some context now, you know, as part of sponsored reporting from corporations who can place them at the center of this investigative work. And you know, Beats by Dre is no different, right?
Yeah. No, this has been happening for a while, but you know, you're going to look for a story, and it's a brutal, tragic story, and you're going to look it up, you do it on the web, and before that happens, like, there's an ad for pizza. And so you do the pizza and the pepperoni, and everybody's smiling, and the cheese, and then the face appears on the screen. You think, where am I living? What century is this?
Right. Yeah.
Well, let's turn now. I want to talk about a documentary now and change subjects a little bit. This is an Amazon Prime documentary called A Most Beautiful Thing, and it is about students on the west side of Chicago who became the first Black high school rowing team. You're from Chicago, Natalie. You remember this team? You remember watching them row?
I don't. And it's funny, you know, when I saw that the high school was Manly, and I'm fairly familiar with Manly because my grandmother lived on the West Side for many years. I reached out to a friend of mine that I grew up with who lived on the Southwest Side and, you know, familiar with the school. And I was like, you have got to watch this because I'm really interested in knowing what you would think about, like, this row team and how Chicago is represented in this film. You know, which I definitely have critiques, but overall, I'm just really, I felt like I know these guys, that I know people who are like these men who were a part of this row team. You know, I'm familiar with, I mean, Chicago is one of the most segregated cities in the country. So there's a way that if you grow up Black in Chicago, you know the general story. You know what the landscape is. And even though I didn't live on the West Side, I was very familiar with it. You know, and it's kind of a remarkable thing to think about these young Black men from a neighborhood that is riddled with violence, to, you know, be out on the water rowing, doing something that is typically seen as very elite. And so I think, you know, on the one hand, that it's a really beautiful image. It's a beautiful thing to think about and to consider. But I also think that there's a way that the way that the film sets up these young men and sort of talks about, you know, this transformation that happens on the water is almost like, you know, music tames the savage beast. Like, that is what I felt was being presented. Like, just imagine these young Black men, you know, in this row, you know, in this boat on the Chicago River, and they've never seen it before. And here comes you know, the skyscrapers in the you know, in the distance. I think that there's a lot going on.
Right.
I'm not sure that it all comes together in a way that, you know, really pays homage to the city or the young men.
Well, the film is a most beautiful thing. It is an independent production available on Amazon Prime. And Mark, you brought the documentary to our attention. What stands out to you?
Yeah, you know, to Natalie's point, I think it's interesting, right? Because I wonder, as a viewer, do you feel the same way if this is a film about them going into track and field, or if it's a film like Hoop Dreams, you know, right. as another Chicago story about going into basketball. And I mean, I think one of the important stories of this narrative is, right, how do we begin to think outside the box in the way that we want young Black folks to channel their energies, right? Because it'd be all too easy, just get out on the track, just get out on the football field, just get out on the basketball field, a basketball court. And it takes a lot of commitment to think about rowing as this option. You know, for me, one of the most important parts of this story was, you know, how it gets done. The idea that you could have these four African-American men who were connected in certain kinds of ways, you know, NBA, former NBA players in terms of Dwayne Wade and Grant Hill, Common, you know, the rapper, actor, activist, who, of course, is Chicago-based, and then to bring someone like Patrick Douthat, Ninth Wonder, into the mix, you know, as executive producer, but he also did the soundtrack. You know, it speaks to the ways that, you know, if we want to tell these stories, we're going to have to tell these stories. The fact that very few people in the city of Chicago knew about the story. And even, you know, one of the most, you know, heartbreaking moments for me was that how many of their families, their mothers, their brothers, their sisters, aunts and uncles, fathers, never actually got to see them compete. Yeah. You know, because in some ways they couldn't even take them serious, you know, in that endeavor.
Well, and I want to play a clip from the film now and just talk about, and I think, Natalie, to your point, Mark, you were talking a little bit about it. They were surprised, too. And to some of that, the film does kind of exoticize some of this. It looks down and said, oh, wow, imagine that scene. But there's a way in which those kids who participated in this also found it pretty amazing. And so here's a little bit from the film.
When I actually looked around the room, it was like, I wonder how that's going to work. All us guys from different parts of the neighborhood, this is like destruction waiting to happen.
These kids were sons of drug addicts, sons of prostitutes, sons of drug dealers.
This is going to be a boat full of people with knots on their heads and fighting and cursing. Somebody's going to be in the water by the end of the day.
It was like a family. Families bicker, they fight, but all together, well, like, but now.
But it wasn't family.
It wasn't family at first. No.
That's from the documentary A Most Beautiful Thing, featuring the voices of Manly High School rowing team. And we're talking about it today on Back Channel with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. How did you feel about the balance, Mark, the sense of sort of from the outside looking in, saying, wow, imagine that. But as you said, did you get the sense that these were young men telling their own story, or was it being told about them?
I think it's a little of both. I think, you know, the movie presses towards the end and having them get back in the boat and compete again. You know, I think there's a way in which, you know, as a viewer, you wanted the film to end on a high note, you know, with them as youngsters and not having to deal with the reality of their lives, you know, after that point in time. But I think to the extent that they were able to actually vocalize their concerns and their stories and talk about where they are now. So it's not just some photos, you know, at the end of the documentary, you know, placards saying this person lived to this and did this and that, that they could kind of, you know, contribute to that story, I think was important. Right. And again, it's based on a book. Right? And so the book obviously brings a level of depth, you know, to that story that we don't necessarily get in the documentary.
I'm going to play one more clip from Ashray Cooper, the captain of the Manly team, who initially had the idea to invite police officers. And this is sort of part of it, is bringing the cops in when the revelation is, what about if we had police join us in all of this? And here he is talking about that invitation.
If the whole world disagreed, right, what I saw in the film that was awesome is that the moms agreed. Because, you know, the moms have a fear of losing their sons to gang violence. And the moms have a fear of losing their sons to the hands of police, the hands of police brutality. Those are two big fears that they have. And we were already connecting the gang members, right? And that was working. And we're trying to show how that works through access and opportunities and through dialogue. And I felt like I needed to have a conversation with the police officer. And what better way to do it than through sports? And, you know, you teachers can forget some of their students, not all, but some of their students. But students never forget a teacher. And to teach them how to row is something that I think they would never forget, right? And and I got a call, a text when George Floyd was killed, and that showed me when they seen his face, they seen our face. They remember the teacher. And I thought that was really important. And that was the goal, to bridge the water, to bridge the community through sports.
Arshe Cooper talking about the film, A Most Beautiful Thing. I'm talking about it with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, what's your reaction to that clip?
I mean, I have a lot of thoughts. I think the main thing that I'm thinking about is that I really appreciate the extent to which the film really breaks down and talks about the trauma. You know, Arshe talks about how the moms really appreciated, loved the idea of these guys rowing with police officers to try and bridge the gap between these two groups, right? But, there's a reality to what these men experienced as young people. And the film talks about, you know, the PTSD that's found in, these neighborhoods, that these kids, the trauma that these kids experience. But I don't think it goes far enough to really talk about, okay, if we're going to bring people together to row, how can we address the deeper issue, the deeper systemic issue?
Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal teaches at Duke, and we'll be right back talking about how COVID-19 has made its mark in popular culture and social justice movements. It's all just ahead on Back Channel. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown are with me today for Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. So let's look at how COVID-19 and Black Lives Matter have been represented in popular culture, particularly in the fall TV season. Network TV, television has had time to adjust. It's all being reflected now back to us. Along with these movements, Mark, what stuck out to you in this new season of TV?
You know, there were two series that really stuck out. One, a sitcom, you know, with Cedric the Entertainer, The Neighborhood, and the other one, a drama also on CBS called All Rise. And I was struck by a couple of things. One, that they both openly dealt with both the COVID crisis, but also the George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, you know, moment in this time. And it was striking to me, you know, I had a conversation with an executive producer of Black-ish a few weeks ago, and he talked about the fact that, to be honest to what was going on, they were going to shoot two or three episodes to directly dealt with it, you know, directly. But then they were going to ease back, particularly on the COVID piece, right, because they were producing something that they thought needed to have some longevity, and we might not feel the same way watching COVID, you know, episodes 5 years from now than we do now. And I think in the case of these CBS dramas, you know, definitely CBS drama, that they're working this into the larger narrative of a show that deals with social justice and the criminal justice system head on, that the only way they could really do it authentically, right, was to take up these dual issues in the context of the storylines.
You know, well, but it's going to keep academics like you busy for a long time, going back into the archive, writing whole books on just the COVID series and kind of what that meant. But Natalie, what do you make of this? The way, again, you know, I mean, you're too young to remember when Newt Minow called television a vast wasteland, and because it would never take on this kind of stuff. It is now, and I'm just wondering about how you see these things coming together, popular culture, particularly through TV, social justice issues, which have some ascendancy, at least in the moment, and then the pandemic. How do you see them coming together or not?
Honestly, I have not. I don't pay a lot of attention to network television, so I am not as up on what Mark is talking about as he is. But I will say that I think that the at least Black Lives Matter, to the extent that it has really had an impact on streaming services like Netflix and HBO, I think that they have made an effort and maybe have turned a corner in terms of what type of programming they are pushing, and that they're making an effort to be more concerned about their Black audience and provide more material that's not only representative of Black life, but that's actually produced and directed by Black folks. And so I think that that is an interesting development. How long that will last, who knows? But I think that's part of what I see right now.
What's the blend, Mark, do you think, of sort of the argument that, look, I watch TV to escape. This is where I go to get away from the headlines. And now here it is on TV. I can't go anywhere without seeing this.
You know, to get to the point that Natalie just made in the earlier point I made about, you know, white American epiphanies, you know, Black Lives Matter and Black creative forces have been putting pressures on mainstream television and cable television streaming services for years, right? And it just happens to be a moment. I think about, you know, the small act series that Steve McQueen, you know, has produced for Amazon. You know, Mangrove Nine was the first one to broadcast this past Friday. And even though it was shot a year ago, right, before any of this stuff happened in the U.S., it is so timely, right, in the way that it's capturing these energies that were taking place in Britain 50 years ago that, you know, are similar to some of the energies that we're seeing now. So I think in that regard, you know, if you are Black creative, you know, it's not like this is a moment of opportunity, right? This is really an affirmation of the kind of work that you wanted to do. I think All Rise was really interesting because they were one of the few series that when COVID first hit, you know, they were committed to finishing some aspect of their season, and they shot the first episode, you know, during COVID, you know, basically folks on Zooms, right? So the idea of integrating what it meant to do courts now via Zoom as opposed to, you know, the way that you historically had done trials and cases of that nature. So I think it was cutting edge in that regard.
Well, we've talked about it so far from the industry standpoint. Let's take a look at it from the consumer side, Mark, and I'll stick with you and then ask you, Natalie, what impact do you think it's had on movements, on social movements?
You know, I think when this happens in sitcoms, whether we're talking, you know, The Neighborhood or Black-ish, I don't think people 5 years from now are going to think of this as the high point in terms of television production in that regard. And I think for given everything that's going on in the world, to be able to have some of these subject matters captured in a way that's a little bit more lighthearted, you know, than what it looks like, you know, on the 7 a.m. news stories, or whether it's television or NPR. You know, I think there's a way to find some sort of balance, you know, that allows us to actually laugh at, you know, the trauma that's going on, even as we're dealing with it on a daily basis.
What about you, Natalie? Impact?
You know, I'm thinking about BET's, I think it was the Hip Hop Awards earlier in the summer, and which were completely, you know, social distance. Everything was done virtually. And, you know, how amazing that show was in spite of, right? And so I think that there's a way, and Saturday Night Live did, you know, had to do similar things. I think that there's a way that, you know, certainly I agree with Mark that when folks study this period of time and television during it, you know, they're not going to say this was like the, you know, the landmark moment. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's something useful about being able to see these shows pivot, these networks be able to pivot and do what they need to do to still present content, to still present what their fans, their consumers expect. And I think that it'll be interesting, I'll say, what the balance will be, what kind of balance will be struck. Because I don't think COVID, even though COVID may go away, I think from what I've been reading, we're still going to be a little nervous about being as close and being, you know, as many of us gathering together as we did pre-pandemic. So I think that's going to have an impact for sure.
Well, I guess the other big question is the impact of radio shows like this on discourse and conversation and the way we think about things. And I'm sad to say this is our last moment together, our last back channel on WUNC. And all I can say is that it has been such an honor and such a pleasure. And I need to thank you so much for what you've done for this program, for this radio station, for what you have done for public radio in general and our community by elevating the conversation, holding our feet to the fire, and making sure that we are considering the issues that we should consider in ways that we should consider them and not let go of them, in the same way that we can't, you know, sort of stop socially distancing because we're sick and tired of the epidemic. We can't walk away from this conversation just because we had it yesterday on account of the issues that persist. And the way that you've elevated the conversation on this radio station and made us a better radio station for it is very hard to describe, and all I can do is thank you. It's been a great run, and I'm going to miss you both, but I think it's been great, and I appreciate it. Let me ask you a question about what you think has happened. I mean, to reflect back over the time that we've been on together doing this show, and you've been on in different iterations and for different reasons even before that. But talk about the beginning of this segment, Back Channel, and just think back to the way the conversations we were having back then and the way they've changed now. Maybe I can ask you to just kind of reflect that broadly for us. Natalie?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you to you, Frank, for being open to this type of show. And thanks to Mark, for inviting me to be a part of the 25th anniversary celebration of The Cosby Show, which is how he and I had the opportunity to come on the State of Things, talk about what The Cosby Show had meant, which is almost like anathema in my mouth now because of all that's happened since then. But, you know, it was an amazing opportunity to, you know, chop it up with Mark and get to know you. And it's just amazing to me. You know, I can't thank Hadi, the producer who was working with the State of Things.
Hadi Mawagdi. Hadi.
Yes. Hadi, you know, was like, that was great. You know, you all should do this more often. Maybe we can do something regularly. And he's really, you know, the spark. So thank you, Hadi, in Texas. And, you know, it's just been an incredible thing. When I think about it's been 5 years, I never would have imagined we'd still be here.
Yeah. Mark?
You know, a couple of things. You know, 25, 30 years ago, my favorite NPR show was Talk of the Nation. And there was a way that when I first heard you, Frank, on the State of Things in 2005, it harked back to the energy, right, in terms of a host who was incredibly informed, had a range of interests, right, read a range of things and could bring that to bear, you know, in conversations, even when those conversations were explicitly local. I'm always going to thank you because, you know, you had the wherewithal in your production team at some point to bring Patrick Douthat and I, Knife Wonder, in the studio. It was the first time we met. And as we sat there and talked off air before we went live and had this conversation about being girl dads, you know, that sprung now into, you know, a 15-year friendship and professional relationship. And that's a, you know, that's a Frank Stacio moment, right? That's a State of Things moment. But when I think about the show, you know, when we first got started, right, in the midst of Black Lives Matter, but we still had a black president, and the conversations were more hopeful, I think, even in the midst of that. And if you listen to the archive of the 5 years of the show, right, you hear us go through, right, these shifts, right, you know, when things are less optimistic, right, where things are more dire, right? We go from Afro-optimistic in 2015 to distinctly Afro-pessimistic, you know, by early 2017, but also the opportunity to have a space to mark some of the losses. I will never forget the conversation that we had about Fife and A Tribe Called Quest, you know, which occurred at the same time around Donald Trump's election and Chappelle hosting that first SNL. I mean, that was a moment where I thought the show really found its voice in being able to parlay, you know, what was happening in the world and also locally, right, and how we could impact upon those conversations.
Right, and we have to thank Charlie Shelton Orman, too, who was the producer
Absolutely.
Of this segment when we got started, because our question, we knew you two should be together on this show. That was obvious, and we knew what the topic was going to be generally, but how do we sustain an hour? I mean, how do we not sound like everybody else talking about this subject in the same way. And yeah, that we really wanted to make sure we were talking about it in that unique way. Remember that Cosby conversation, you talk about the things that had come to pass since, it was in the midst of that trouble. And you courageously got on and we had to talk about the fact that, look, that there was some good television that was being done by a man who now is disgraced. How do we handle that? And what does that mean to a group of people who you know, are already facing the difficulties and challenges that Black people face in America? And now, you know, sort of this confluence of events. And to courageously come on and talk very honestly about every aspect of that, the quality of the production, the quality of the talent, and the tragedy of the story and the way it went. That's what made it unique. And also the lens, which Charlie helped us find, which would be popular culture. Precisely what we're talking about today, the way in which Americans love and are happy to commodify the cultural production that's come out of the Black experience, an experience that is marked by trauma, which not everybody who consumes the product has to experience. And so how do we have that conversation using popular culture as the lens? And I think we thank Charlie for that. And again, your ability to understand how that is the springboard for an intelligent conversation. So I think it's great stuff. And to your credit, that we're going to do it. There's going to be more. There's going to be at least one more back channel. I won't be host. I'll be off in retirement land. But the conversations will continue. Yeah. Talk about just I've got about a minute left, but your sense of where we are headed, Mark, because even back then, everybody, you, both of you, cautioned, look, we're not post-racial just because we have a Black president. So there was an element of caution even back then. But where are we now? And where does the conversation go now in public radio?
I think the irony of having a white president who has an affinity for Black folks and Joe Biden is that people would be more willing to hold him accountable in ways that we weren't necessarily willing to hold, at least publicly hold, the first Black president accountable. And I think, you know, this show, like the station and other NPR outlets, you know, it's a challenge, right? You know, in some ways, you know, the kind of news and journalism that you do is under attack, has been under assault for the last 4 years. It's been economically under assault for a long time, right? Because it's, you know, it's supporter. It's through, you know, supporter donations that much of it happens. But hopefully it'll be a space where we can still continue to have very honest and substantive conversations about the world that we live in.
Natalie?
I just want to say, you know, I totally agree with Mark, and I really lament the fact that, you know, your voice and your understanding, Frank, your sensitivity, your introspection, will not be a part of the types of conversations that maybe Mark and I will continue to have, that will continue to be had, because I think that you have really, you've sort of set the table in a way for us to be able to have these conversations with a really high, I think, rigorous bar. I think all of us have brought that, but I don't think we could have delved as deep if you were not who you are. So I just want to lift you up in that way and thank you for that.
I appreciate that. Your voices will continue to be heard and I will continue to be felt in this community, but no longer as a mediated experience. It's time to get the boots on the ground and let hearts beat in the same room to see what kind of change we can make that way. So you haven't gotten rid of me. You just don't have me on the radio anymore. Natalie Bullock, but thank you so much. Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker, teaching assistant, and professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal is the James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University, author and host of the webcast Left of Black. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. That's it for the State of Things today. Tomorrow is my last live show on the State of Things, and then you can't get rid of me. You'll just, all December, every other day, well, I'll be going into the archive. Anita Raw will be here with some live shows. We're not going anywhere. Not yet. Not yet. State of Things is produced by Anita Raw, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Elikam Dodor is our intern. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Wodarski helped engineer the show today. North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.